I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Gunmen in Baghdad killed an Iranian diplomat as he sat in his car earlier today. It could have been a random killing by any one of the groups operating in Iraq these days, shooting at a foreigner in a car with diplomatic plates. But if it wasn't random, it could be part of a very Byzantine game involving the U.S., Iran, and the Sunni and Shiite Islamic factions of Iraq. We're joined by Patrick Clawson, Director of Research at the Washington Institute of Near East Policy. Welcome, Patrick.
Glad to be with you.
Patrick, thanks for joining us. What's your best sense of who killed Khalil Naimi, the first secretary of the Iranian embassy?
There's a multitude of suspects. This is one of the most complicated stories you can possibly imagine. The suspects would include, for instance, those who were opposed to there being some kind of an Iranian role in defusing the crisis between this radical Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and the Americans. It could be those who want to foment trouble between Sunnis and Shias. Or, as you said, it could have been just a random shooting.
Now, as you suggested, Iranian envoys are on their way to Najaf, where Muqtada al-Sadr is holed up. 2,500 American troops around Najaf. The Iranians are there to possibly negotiate some sort of a solution to the standoff.
They're going to primarily reinforce the message which Muqtada al-Sadr is already hearing from Iraqis. Muqtada al-Sadr is a proud Iraqi nationalist who didn't get along so well with the Iranians when he went to visit there last summer, and he would not appreciate the idea that the Iranians should tell him what to do.
Do the United States and Iran have shared interests, perhaps more shared interests than they've had in a long time in Iraq?
Well, that gets complicated because the Iranians don't want to see Iraq dissolve into chaos. There is some basis for cooperation. On the other hand, Iran does not want the United States to succeed in Iraq. They want the U.S. to get bogged down and the U.S. to have to leave in disgrace. And so the Iranians have thousands of agents on the ground in Iraq who are, frankly, causing a lot of worry to the U.S. authorities there. And these guys are, most of them are taking a more neutral stance towards the U.S. at the moment than Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army. But it's disturbing to think that there are all of these Iranian-trained and equipped guys in Iraq.
Now, Muqtada al-Sadr, the young firebrand cleric, is arguably still a minority phenomenon in Iraq. The quietest cleric, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, has by far the greatest following among Iraqis. He is not someone who believes in a political role for religious leaders. Now, he lived in Iran for many years. What is his relationship with Iran?
He does not like the current Iranian government because, as you said, he's a quietist. He doesn't like this politicization of religion, where people who are upset in Iran about their tax bills decide to stop going to mosque or fasting or during Ramadan. And Sistani's vision is one that's shared by most Iranians, which is one reason why the majority of Iranians making religious contributions give it to Sistani's agents inside Iran, and they collect tens of millions of dollars a year. And Sistani, in fact, provides much, if not most, of the money that goes to support religious studies in Iran. So there's a very complicated dance going on here between the Iranian clergy and government on the one hand and the Iraqi clergy on the other.
Patrick Clawson is Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you much.
A new audio tape, which the CIA is now saying is probably the voice of Osama bin Laden, offers European countries a truce if they withdraw their soldiers from Muslim lands. Stop spilling our blood so we can stop spilling your blood, the speaker says. He refers to recent events, including the Madrid bombings. He also criticizes the U.S., saying the real problem is the occupation of all of Palestine. And he vows revenge for the killing of Hamas founder Sheikh Ahmad Rasin. Journalist and author Ahmed Rashid joins us now from his home in Lahore, Pakistan. Welcome.
Hello.
And are you convinced that this is indeed Osama bin Laden?
Yes, it certainly seems so. Most people in the Middle East who have heard the tape say it does sound like him, and everyone seems to be taking it very seriously indeed.
How do you see this call for a truce, which the speaker is opening up for 3 months?
Well, I think this is a new strategic direction that bin Laden is trying to give his followers and the all the various groups around the world in some 68 countries now. And he's trying to create a division between Europe and the Americans. Having seen the success, as it were, of the bombings in Spain.
But most leaders today are saying they would never respond to a terrorist request on a tape like this.
Well, certainly. I mean, I certainly don't see any European country responding in any positive way to this. But I think here there is a strategy in which he's informing his al-Qaeda militants, particularly in Europe, that if they launch a terrorist attacks against other European governments, they may well see a similar result from Spain. And the results in Spain, which led, of course, to the toppling of the conservative government and the winning of the socialist government in the elections. At the same time, I think, you know, he's trying here to show that, show the European public at least, that this global jihad is not necessarily global, but does have a strategic and tactical aim behind it.
There's also a focus on the Mideast and what the speaker calls the American occupation of Palestinian territories. Is this a shift in focus from what we've heard before from bin Laden?
Certainly since 9/11, bin Laden has been concentrating on the American presence in the Middle East, its support to Israel, and certainly today's news about President Bush's meeting with Prime Minister Sharon is probably going to intensify militant attacks against Israel in the Middle East. I think also this tape is a major blow to American and Pakistani efforts along the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. In recent weeks, there have been major sweeps and offensives by the Americans and the Pakistanis to try and catch bin Laden. What bin Laden is demonstrating with this tape is that you can do what you like to catch me, but I'm still able to address the world.
Is it possible also, Ahmed, that Osama bin Laden has been weakened by the war on terror, and so now he's taking a political tactic?
Well, I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think up to 70% of the leaders of al-Qaeda, who were leaders at least before 9/11, have been caught or killed. What we are seeing now, of course, is a multi-headed hydra where it is not the old al-Qaeda that is carrying out these bombings around the world in Spain or Uzbekistan and in other countries, but local groups who may have only one or two members of the old al-Qaeda alongside them, but local groups who are mobilizing on the ideology that bin Laden has been advocating for the last few years. What this tape is doing is trying to keep these local groups mobilized and on the offensive, and in fact even create more recruits for them.
Journalist Ahmed Rashid, his latest book is Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He spoke to us from his home in Lahore, Pakistan.
The Palestinian Authority is threatening today to cancel all commitments to past peace accords, following an agreement between Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and President George Bush that allows Israel to maintain some Jewish settlements on the West Bank. The unilateral plan, conceived without Palestinian participation, would also deny Palestinians the right of return to properties lost at the time of the creation of the State of Israel. Gaza would be handed over to Palestinian Authority, and all settlements there would be dismantled. Michael Tarazi is the legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. He joins us on the line from Ramallah. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, Bill.
Michael, let's start with the settlements on the West Bank. Sharon reportedly wants to keep five or so major settlement blocks. And, Michael, these are facts on the ground, are they not? At this point, what can Palestinians do about the Bush-Sharon plan?
Well, that's right. I mean, these settlements are towns. There are approximately 400,000 settlers living in the territories occupied in 1967. And the reason they were created was precisely for the results they got yesterday from the American administration, which was to say it's too late, we've taken this land, and the Palestinians simply have to accept it. What I'm very disturbed by is that the accord yesterday reached between President Bush and Ariel Sharon in effect rewards Israel for its violations of international law. It is a very dangerous position taken by the United States, and I, as an American citizen, was really rather shocked by it. I couldn't believe that the United States, at a time when America is trying to establish credibility in the Middle East, would turn around and take a position that, in effect, abandons the rule of law, that does not promote democracy, and continues to suppress freedom for the Palestinians.
Michael, you say dangerous. What do you mean?
Well, I think it's dangerous because President Bush's policy, in effect, feeds into the arguments of the extremists. And I think we saw that this morning with Hamas's statement that said President Bush's total abandonment of Palestinian rights, in effect, is proof of the fact that the United States will never defend international law, will never force Israel to abide by UN resolutions and the Fourth Geneva Convention. And the extremists argue that, therefore, the Palestinians have to do whatever they can, as immoral as it might be, to defend themselves and enforce their rights. And since they don't have F-16s and Apache helicopter gunships, they'll fight any way they can, including their own using their own bodies as weapons. That's a very dangerous message to be sending to the Palestinian extremists.
But you, as you say, using their bodies as weapons, Israelis have already felt they're under siege from Palestinian suicide bombers. Why would they negotiate?
But they never really negotiated even before. Even during the negotiations prior to the uprising and the suicide bombers, Israel continued to build the settlements. Now, of course, they just simply have the excuse. And in effect, what the American administration did yesterday was, we're not going to deal with anything. We're just going to let Israel do whatever it wants. And I just don't see how that's in America's national interest, and I certainly don't see how that's in the peace interests of both Israelis and Palestinians.
So what happens next, Michael? Is the peace process now, once and for all, a corpse?
I think that basically it really wasn't a peace process, and I think that Sharon and even previous Israeli governments have always used the disguise of the so-called peace process to further their goal, and I think that that's simply going to continue.
What is the mood among Palestinians today?
You know, there are some Palestinians, such as myself, who are genuinely shocked the Americans would make such a decision that is so against the American interest and the American value system. But most Palestinians sort of shrug their shoulders and say, well, what do you expect? This is the United States. And I was personally surprised. I was aghast to see an American president wholesale adopt the policies and the dictates of Ariel Sharon. I wondered at some point whether or not the White House was Israeli-occupied territory.
There's a sense, then, among Palestinians of impotence.
Well, that's very much what it means to be under occupation. You don't have a military. You don't have any political power. You don't have any economic power. Precisely because of an American failure to live up to its own stated values, we are in this mess that we're in today.
And the consequence, more violence.
I think that's certainly going to be one of the consequences, but I think that you might even see more political consequences, widespread resentment of the United States around the Middle East and even abroad, and certainly it's not going to help the war on terrorism. I think that you'll see in Iraq the United States will have less and less sympathy from the Iraqi people, and eventually this may just cause Palestinians to say once and for all, it's very clear that we're not going to get a real state, and we're not going to get our rights, and so therefore perhaps we need to reevaluate our struggle and perhaps start talking about one state where we have equal citizenship with Jews.
Michael Tarazi is the legal advisor to the PLO. He joined us on the line from Ramallah. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Saudis face a new economic reality, having to get a job.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
During the oil boom of the 1970s, a tidal wave of dollars poured into Saudi Arabia, and many Saudis simply stopped working and started collecting government checks. Foreign workers from around the world were hired to do many jobs, which quickly lost their prestige, no matter how high-powered or titled that job might be. But for the first time in recent years, Saudis are returning to the job force and changing the nature of work in that country. That's according to Hugh Pope, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal based in Istanbul, Turkey. And Hugh joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Hannah.
Well, there is change now, but tell us more about what it's been like. If most Saudi Arabians aren't doing the work in Saudi Arabia, who is?
It's one of those extraordinary things about Saudi Arabia is how many people are actually there. Currently, we think there's about 22 million, and anything between 5 and 7 million foreigners and about 16 million Saudis. And those 5 to 7 million foreigners are doing basically all the heavy lifting in Saudi Arabia.
You write that 9 of 10 jobs in the Saudi private sector are held by foreign workers from Bangladesh, Pakistan, Americans.
That's right. There's no one else who will sweep the streets for $200 a month, and that's what the Bangladeshis do. And there are some jobs which Americans are best at $20,000 a month. That's how it's been for the last 20, 30 years in Saudi Arabia, that foreigners have been looked at as kind of the hired help. And for the Saudi Arabians themselves, it encouraged this sense that work was for other people.
So what's happened? Why have things changed?
There's been a number of changes. One is the great shock of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait back in 1990, which shocked the Saudis out of their complacency and made them realize that they were vulnerable on a strategic level. And then came the oil shock of the mid to late 1990s as well, where suddenly the Saudi budget went deep into the red. So the Saudi exchequer could no longer afford to keep everyone afloat. And on the job market, you've got about 150,000 people coming out of the job market every year now. There's a tidal wave of people, if you like. And there's only about 100,000 jobs available for them. They have nothing to do at all, except, as we've seen, in some cases, a very few terrorist cases make a lot of trouble.
Right. Well, as you write, there's been car theft and joyriding, but of course, 15 of the 19 hijackers and the September 11th attacks were young Saudis, and some say young Saudis with not much to do. Well, now, as you said, things have changed. The monarchy is starting a Saudization with jobs training programs aiming to replace foreign workers with Saudi workers. And it's produced some interesting stories.
Yeah, the image that struck me was when someone told me there was a gold mine where Saudis were working deep underground. The first time that they tried to get Saudis to work as miners, the British and South African expatriates who ran the mine just said no. Their experience of Saudis had been so unprofessional. And a new generation of Saudi manager who'd just taken over the mine, and he was determined to prove those expatriates wrong. So he went round to the desert around the mine, and he found a dozen likely lads from the Bedouin tribes who had some experience in driving trucks or bulldozers, which in casual labor kind of thing, because not all Saudis were rich, by the way, but they were certainly not used to Western work ethics. So he got this dozen people, and he trained them up for 3 months. And then he said to the expatriates, right, I'm ready to test these guys and put them down the mine. And the expatriates said, no way. We're responsible for the safety and productivity of the mine, and we can't allow this to happen. We've got perfectly good Filipinos. They're cheap. But no, this manager was insistent. And so he got them to do a race, 30 miles of tunnels that are turned this mountain into a kind of Swiss cheese. And he arranged for a race that the Saudis would show that they could drive the dump trucks to the top in a certain time. And indeed, half of the Saudis managed to at least equal or better the best Filipino score.
And as you write, one of the ways he encouraged them was a cheer, sort of like a football huddle cheer, you know, whose land is this? Our tribes, you know, to kind of inspire them to work, which it strikes me that there's a whole generation that, or at least much of a whole generation, that won't know what that means, to work.
Yeah, there is no history of, for instance, office work. I mean, there's no tradition of office culture. Half of Saudi Arabians a generation ago lived in the desert. And for instance, one of the problems that one of the managers of the mine said was that when they started out, if a guest arrives at your tent in the Saudi desert, it is your duty, it is your, you are absolutely beholden unto that guest, and you must look after him. So if a guest arrived at someone's tent while they were supposed to be working down digging out gold ore, they would have to leave and go back to their tent and look after the guest, because otherwise their social structure would collapse and condemn them.
Before we let you go, just a couple more images as a longtime traveler to Saudi Arabia.
I think that the biggest change over the last 2 years is what's happened in the hotels in Saudi Arabia. Before, they were completely run by foreigners, and the Saudis were only people who came in and left their big Mercedes, BMWs, and Chryslers at the door and would come in and enjoy a big meal and leave or so forth. Now, when you check into your hotel in Jeddah, And I nearly fell over when I first saw this. There was a Saudi man as a bellhop, but he didn't quite fit into his uniform because he was quite bulky. But he was doing the job, and he wanted to do the job. I nearly fell over when the first Saudi told me over a hotel counter, "Is there anything more I can do to help you, sir?" That's something you never, ever heard in Saudi Arabia. It made Saudi Arabia feel normal.
Hugh Pope, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hugh Pope, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He's based in Istanbul, Turkey. He wrote about the changes in the workforce in Saudi Arabia. And this note, CNN and Reuters are now reporting that the State Department is expected to ask some U.S. non-essential diplomats and all U.S. dependents to leave Saudi Arabia because of security concerns.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, one student story about skyrocketing tuition. Following in Michael Moore's footsteps, he made fruitless attempts to talk to the governor of Maryland about increased tuition at state schools. He turned his quest into a film.
And this week, the 9/11 Commission focused on the failures of the intelligence community to alert the White House to the threat of terrorists. We asked, did journalists also fail in covering this story? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Today is April 15th, Tax Day, in case you haven't noticed. You've got less than 12 hours to get your taxes done. And a new report says that the Internal Revenue Service is enforcing its own rules less than ever. The IRS commissioner says that enforcement is actually up, but numbers analyzed by researchers at Syracuse University give a very different picture. David Burnham is the primary author of the new report, and he joins us now. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me.
David, thanks for joining us. Your analysis is based on numbers provided to you by the IRS. In a nutshell, what did you discover?
We discovered that the tax enforcement effort against business has collapsed. The audits of all businesses are down. The audits of corporations are down. The audits of big corporations are down. Criminal enforcement down. Everything is down, looking at whether the corporate taxpayers are pulling their load.
Down how much?
Well, it depends. Big corporations down by about half in the last 5 years.
Now, what about what hits home with a lot of us, audits of individuals?
Well, for the wealthier individuals, those making over $100,000, that's how that's defined, audits are slightly up. For all individuals, they've remained steady. So that's either steady or up, and business audits are down.
What's going on?
Well, the short answer is that in the last few years, going back into the Clinton, well, even before the Clinton, the administration have requested insufficient money to maintain the staff. So the staff is a lot smaller. And you need expert really trained people to audit a large corporation or a large business. You cannot do it without sufficient staff. So no staff or smaller staff means fewer audits.
You know, this sounds a bit like one of those crocodile tear situations. Oh, what a shame that the IRS isn't auditing people as much as it used to.
Yes. And, in fact, there are certainly members of the House of Representatives who believe, who want to cut government, and one way to do that is not to feed the beast, as they say.
Is there a downside to the IRS not auditing people and corporations as much as it used to?
Oh, big downsides. You know, everybody wants the airports to work, and you want the highways to work, and you want the troops in Iraq to have the right equipment, and you got to have the money to do that. And taxes are the state. They are the essential element of any nation. And without taxes, you know, things fall apart, or with less taxes. It's become very popular to knock the IRS, and everybody says, oh, I'm paying too much taxes, but they're not thinking about what they get from them, it seems to me.
News reports quote IRS Commissioner Mark Everson as saying the decline in IRS enforcement has been stopped and will soon go up dramatically. Your thoughts?
I don't think he can do it. Both the General Accounting Office and a IRS oversight board last week came out with reports saying that the appropriations that the administration asked for will mean that the staff will continue to decline. We're not quite sure what's going on. They claim they want more and they want to do this. And, you know, President Bush runs around saying we're going to go after the corporations. Yet the money they ask for, in fact, means fewer IRS auditors. And that means they just don't have the resources to do it.
Fewer IRS officers. We're talking about hundreds, right? Not thousands.
Yes, but it's gone long-term decline. Every year, a couple of hundred revenue agents, fewer, and so it's going down and down and down. But you need these expert people.
Quick final question: what are your chances of being audited? Say you're an average family making about $80,000 a year.
Somewhere between 1 and 2 out of 1,000.
David Burnham, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Burnham is at the Washington, D.C. office of the Syracuse University Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse. For more information on his report, go to our website, here-now.org.
Well, the government estimates that it will take the average taxpayer 28 hours and 30 minutes to complete their taxes by tonight's midnight deadline. And some people just give up. Low-income families in particular don't have the time for the complicated forms, or they can't afford to pay someone to tackle them. So they often forego filing for their earned income credit, a refundable tax credit averaging about $2,000 for low-wage heads of household. Well, now a program at Colgate University is enlisting economics students to help out in the hopes of saving money for over 200 low-income families in the upstate New York area. Joining us on the line from Hamilton, New York, is Professor Nicole Simpson, director of Colgate University's Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. Welcome.
Hello.
How does the program work? I assume, you don't just plop students down with forms
right.
and families.
Right. Essentially, this is a joint collaboration between Colgate University, the IRS, and also two other local programs called the Department of Social Services and the Community Action Program, both of Madison County. And essentially what happens is the IRS sends representatives to train our students to do taxes. Everything's done, of course, electronically. So it's a matter of teaching the students, most of which who have never done taxes before, what a W-2 is, how taxes work, and essentially showing them the process in using the software program to do taxes.
And tell us a little bit about the families who qualify for earned income tax credit.
Their average income level has been approximately $12,500. Most of these families have children. So, of course, it's well below kind of the poverty level.
And also below the requirement, because I know that there's a cutoff line for the tax.
Right, right. For the earned income credit, if you have two children, any households below $33,000 qualify. If you have one child, the number is at the federal level somewhere around $29,000. If you have no children, it's $11,000. So the more children you have, the more income you can make to still qualify for the tax, the earned income credit.
Right.
This year, the earned income credit represented about 60% of the average refund in our household.
And why do they tell you that they don't do it themselves?
Most of them say the earned income credit, you have to file several extra worksheets, and it actually becomes very complicated. It's just not your standard easy form. They actually have to fill out the 1040 along with several additional worksheets. And so for these families, it's either very complicated and very time-consuming, or if they have a tax professional do the service for them, it can cost them several hundreds of dollars. And for these households, that's a huge hit.
You know, there are people who are listening to this who might be saying, well, gee, I'm glad you're helping these families who are literally being rewarded for working at a very low income.
Right.
But I'm a middle income person and I'm struggling. Have your students help me. You know, I mean, do you hear that? That maybe you should expand the program.
This is a national program sponsored by the IRS, and so for them, their target group is essentially low income. There are also other programs who help, for example, senior citizens, and that's something different from the VITA program.
Professor Simpson, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Professor Nicole Simpson, director of Colgate University's Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, students helping low-income families get their tax credits. She spoke to us from New York.
Still to come, Othello at 400. We review some of the legendary performances of Shakespeare's tale of love and jealousy.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We received this criticism from David Alcott of Stillwater, Oklahoma. I find it disingenuous for you and the rest of the media to refer to the private citizens killed in Fallujah as contractors or security personnel, when in fact they are in Iraq to do what the armed forces are there for without the same accountability. Does this not make them paramilitary?
John Gallagher of Woonsocket, Rhode Island, had this thought following coverage of the 9/11 Commission hearings. Louis Free, the director of the FBI from 1993 to 2001, testified that his agency's ability to prevent 9/11 was frustrated by Congress, which didn't provide sufficient money and resources. How much did it cost in the past, I wonder, to target the American Indian Movement leadership or the Black Panthers?
Following our story on the Cassini probe, which is sending back spectacular images of the planet Saturn and its rings, we received an email from Randy Zeitman of Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. He thanked us for the piece, not only because he loves science, but because we asked whether or not the pictures were worth the price of sending the probe. So we decided to ask him about it.
I have a picture of Saturn on my wall. I love the images so much. But you can't compare, or I can't, the picture of that Saturn on my wall or anything that Hubble can give, or knowing the exact age of the universe, to helping my neighbor overcome his leukemia.
Powerful point, and not that easy to argue with in a way, although if I'm a scientist who's devoted his life to astrophysics, maybe I could put up an argument and say, this is how human beings accumulate knowledge.
And I say that's fine, but what is the purpose of accumulating knowledge if not for improving the quality of life? You know, there is a point of saying for me, you know, what happens if science 50 years ago when the space program began said, well, we're not going to go to space so quick. We're going to focus on the needs. Where would mankind be today? I think mankind would be far ahead. We might have the drugs right now. We need to tackle AIDS and cancer and any other of a laundry list of 1,000 real-world needs.
Randy Zeitman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Sullivan of Phoenix, Arizona, wrote this satirical response to our story about OPEC cutting oil production, thereby raising oil prices. I have a solution, he says, that will decrease prices. First, Bush and company would tell the American public that Saudi Arabia has weapons of mass destruction. Then President Bush would order the imperialist American military machine to attack, bomb, and take over and occupy Saudi Arabia for the causes of freedom and democracy.
And finally, Michael Caracappa of Charlotte, North Carolina, had this response to our conversation with folk critic Scott Alaric about Scottish pop singer Eddie Reader, who's reinterpreting the works of 18th century poet Robert Burns. Not to take anything away from her, but the traditional Scottish ballads can be overwhelmingly beautiful when sung with passion by an accomplished vocalist. Michael sent us many examples. Here's one from Scottish tenor Kenneth McKellar singing Ye Banks and Braes, O Bonnie Doon.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at HERE-NOW.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
This year marks the 400th anniversary of the first production of Shakespeare's Othello, which is, of course, the immortal tale of love and jealousy, in which the Moor Othello comes to believe his adored bride Desdemona has been unfaithful to him. The conniving Iago deceives Othello, who then strangles his beloved in their marital bed. Joining us in the studio to talk about this masterpiece and this anniversary is our theater critic, Bill Marks. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you doing?
Bill, tell us why Othello remains one of Shakespeare's most popular and also one of his most controversial plays.
Well, certainly because of the interracial marriage between Othello and Desdemona. That's always been very, very talked about and has caused the play to have a lot of attention through the years because for centuries, essentially, Othello was played by a white actor, not a black actor. It's only within recent years that a black actor has taken on the role.
Now, a number of companies are scheduled to perform Othello this 400th anniversary year, but tell us about one that's already been on the road for many months now, touring through the States. It's the Guthrie Theater production.
Yes, the Guthrie Theater production is part of the NEA's Shakespeare in America program, and it's a fairly respectable production, it seems to me. It isn't going to really ring any bells to the extent of doing anything innovative or different.
With a black actor in the part of Othello, let's listen to a clip from the Guthrie Theater production. What monologue are we going to hear, Bill, actually?
We're going to be hearing a monologue that's about a little over halfway through, and Iago is really beginning to work on Othello by telling Othello, beware the green-eyed monster, jealousy. And this is Othello's response.
Why is this? Think'st thou I'd make a life of jealousy to follow still the changes of the moon with fresh suspicions? No. To be once in doubt is once to be resolved. Exchange me for a goat when I shall turn the business of my soul to such exsufflicate and blown surmises matching thy inference.
That's Lester Purry in the role, and you can hear that he's a very slow, very deliberate, somewhat stagey, melodramatic delivery. You know, when he says no, you know, it has a touch of sort of Victorian melodrama in it. And I think it's sort of indicative of the production. And certainly, as in many modern productions, Iago, played by Bill McCollum, seems to be a much stronger figure, because I think we identify with the bad guy, and because, like Richard III, he invites us into his plots, and audiences are pulled in. While Othello is a more distanced figure, he doesn't want to tell the story. He's obsessed with stories being told about him, and as such, he's a little more difficult for modern audiences to identify with.
We do love the bad guy.
Yes.
Is there another production of Othello that you've feasted on lately?
Yeah, I saw an extremely interesting one in Stratford upon Avon in England maybe about 2 months ago, and Anthony Scheer, who I think is really one of the great living actors, a South African actor, though he's been acting in England for many years, played Iago. And it was an exciting production. I mean, I saw some fascinating things in the production. I mean, I've never seen, for example, an Iago who was fascinated with Desdemona's undergarments, as he was in this show.
It was a modern touch for you.
A very modern touch. Made him very, very sort of sick. In fact, the sexuality was continually sick in this production, perverse. And I thought that made it interesting. And also, both the Anthony Scheer, who comes from South Africa, and the black actor who played Othello comes from South Africa. And the production did make, I think, subtle use of that undercurrent in terms of apartheid.
Well, let's move from stage to screen. Many great actors have played the part on the silver screen. Two of the best actors ever, Laurence Olivier and Orson Welles.
Right. And let's listen to a little bit of Olivier. And he's going to be doing the same spot, the same passage that we just heard Lester Purry do.
Why is this? Think'st thou I'd lead a life of jealousy to follow still the changes of the moon with fresh suspicions? No. To be once in doubt is once to be resolved. Exchange me for a goat when I shall turn the business of my soul to such exsufflicate and blown surmise matching thy inference?
Here you can, well,
what a contrast, the energy.
I mean, the energy, the anger, in contrast to the more polite, earnest production that we got from the Guthrie. I mean, I wish I had seen that this is a 60s production, a heralded production, and a controversial production. Olivier was one of the great actors in the world, yet even then, the fact that he had to go and he went into blackface in order to play Othello and worked to lower his voice by an octave or two. You know, I mean, that was apparently a volcanic production. and I wish I had seen it. And the film version is a good one, but as you can sort of hear, he's pitched a little too high for film. He's taking a stage performance, which is to play to the back rows, and he's essentially recorded it on film. It's great to see it, but it's a little bit much.
Not what Orson Welles did, who, of course, was one of the great cinematographers, one of the great film artists.
Well, I agree. In his Othello, you see it's a film noir treatment. Essentially, it's in gorgeous black and white. And of course, as usual, Orson didn't have a lot of budget. And so that inflamed his imagination to come up with some fascinating film angles and some fascinating stage misses to make up for the fact that perhaps they didn't have a large budget. As you can hear here, his take on Othello fits well on the screen.
Why is this? Thinks thou I'll make a life of jealousy, to follow still the changes of the moon with fresh suspicions? No, Iago, I'll see before I doubt. When I doubt, prove.
I speak not yet of proof. Look to your wife.
So you can hear here that it's a more intimate approach. It's more of a psychological portrait, that he's not feeling what he seems to be feeling within himself.
You hear the poetry, too, more with Welles than Olivier, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, with Olivier, you're just getting, again, he's acting for the stage, and
yeah.
So he can afford fewer subtleties, as Welles can pick out one or two words to sort of, as you can hear him, purr it out.
Yeah.
And that you don't hear in Olivier's performance. It's more, Olivier is more back to the 19th century version, in a sense, of Othello, which was a man of just bigger than normal men. And that is the continual problem with doing Othello today. There was a Lawrence Fishburne recently did a film version of Othello. And although it's a very adept performance, again, it seems to me to lack the poetry that Welles brought to the role, and neither does it have the sort of the outsized, you know, larger than man sort of feeling that Olivier gives.
Why is this? Thinkst thou I'd make a life of jealousy? To follow still the changes of the moon with fresh suspicions? No. To be once in doubt is once to be dissolved.
The wonderful black actor, Lawrence Fishburne.
Right,
does that issue matter?
Well, it matters more and more to the extent it seems to me would be difficult today to have a white actor in blackface do Othello. Now, later this summer, Shakespeare and Company is going to be doing an Othello, where they're going to have the actor playing Iago and the actor playing Othello change from performance to performance. In other words, one performance, a black actor will be Othello. The next performance, he will be Iago. Hmm. Iago will be playing, you know, Iago one performance and then playing Othello the next. And in an interesting way to sort of play around with the racial politics of the roles.
Finally, Bill, one of the more intriguing versions of Othello ever put on the screen was called Trust, Seduction, Betrayal. Tell us about that.
Not one of my favorites. I mean, this is an attempt to take Shakespeare, remove the language, and essentially just update the plot. So in this case, it's set in high school. The figure of Othello is a winning basketball player on the team. You know, Desdemona is played by a cheerleader. Iago is played by the coach's, you know, son who's jealous. And without the language, it just seems to me that, you know, is sort of as if you stubbed your toe,
Well, let's hear a cut anyway.
It's like the only reason I ever wanted to do something big. So that she'll be proud to stand next to me. Look, is she cheating on me or not? What the f***?
Well, the play survived 400 years. I'm sure it will survive all the other versions of it still to come, huh?
You could safely predict that will not do Othello any lasting damage. And if it brings some people who see the film to actually maybe experience the play and Shakespeare's glorious language, then it would have done a service.
You bet. Here announced theater critic Bill Marks on the 400th anniversary of Othello. Bill, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
For more information on Shakespeare's Othello, check out our website at here-now.org.
And that's music from the opera Othello by Verdi.
And Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Metzen, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette and Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.